So we shall move to the last talk before the coffee break from Carl Philipp Heisenberg from IST Vienna. And the title of his talk is O-plasmic segregation in zebrafish.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. What I would like to speak about is O-plasmic segregation in zebrafish. And I just show you in this movie what the processes we are trying to understand in this and what I will speak about in this talk. This is a zebrafish oocyte, and what you can see is that the ooplasm is flowing up to the animal pool, accumulates up here, and the blue stuff is the yolk granules, which are ending up in the vegetable pool. So essentially, during ooplasmic segregation, you sort of segregate ooplasm to the animal pool and yolk granules to the vegetable pool. Before I tell you about what we have done on ooplasmic segregation, I would like to give you a little introduction about what we are generally doing in the lab to sort of give you a framework of how we are approaching this specific process here. So very generally spoken, what we are interested in the lab is morphogenesis, and we are trying to understand how folds are being generated within during embryogenesis, zebrafish embryogenesis, how folds are being transmitted and how they are being received within the embryo. And very roughly spoken, the process we are interested in is zebrafish gastrulation. It essentially is the process where the blastoderm sitting on top of a very big yolk cell transforms into something which looks like a proper embryo at the end of gastrulation, where the embryo has a head structure, a tail structure, an anterior posterior polarity, a left right polarity, and a dorsal bench polarity. This is what we generally are interested in. What I will speak about is the process a little bit earlier when the blastoderm has not yet formed. So, we are going back in development a little later. Okay, so what we did over the last 18 years is looking at fourth generation here, particularly at the contribution of actin and myosin and actomyosin flows in fourth generation. We have looked at one process which is shown here on the left side, where we are looking at a squamous epithelial cell layer, which is called the enveloping layer. It sits on top of the blastoderm, and what the enveloping layer is doing is showing in this movie. It moves over the yolk cell, thereby undergoing massive epithelial cell layer spreading. And we have asked how the folds are being generated, which lead to EVL and enveloping layer spreading. And we have identified an actomyosin ring-like structure, which is formed within the yolk cell, which is shown here in the screen schematic here. And this actomyosin ring-like structure involves actomyosin flows, and this is shown here. And these flows are actually flows which are retrograde, which are going opposite to the movement of the EVL. You can see, I think this is myosin and this is actin, and the flows are oriented in the opposite direction to the movement of the EVL downwards. And what we have proposed here is sort of a flow friction motor, where the flow of actin and myosin in the opposite direction of the EVL is resisted by some friction to adjacent structures within the yolk cell, yolk granules, anything you wish to assume here. And this resisted flow, this friction-resisted flow, generates a pulling force on the margin of the EVL and pulls it downwards. Actomyosin flows have been analyzed for many years already, and particularly in the context of cell migration, and that's what we looked in another study. We identified a type of cell migration, a very fast type of cell migration, where a few cells within the embryo migrate extremely fast. They're migrating up to 20 micrometer per minute. Usually cells in the embryo move 2 micrometer per minute. And this movement, not surprisingly, is generated with very fast retrograde flows of actin and myosin. You can see actin here. These flows are again at a scale of 20 to 30 micrometer per minute. And that really propels these cells forward, and they are forming this interesting sort of stable blep-like structure in the front. Okay, this is what we did on fourth generation and particularly the function of actomyosin flows in fourth generation. We also have looked at force balance and force transmission within the embryo, and we do that in the framework of interfacial tensions and the balance of interfacial tensions. We have looked here at one process we are quite interested in that is cell cell adhesion. We are looking at two cells from the embryo forming a contact, and we ask how the size of the contact and the stability of the contact is being determined. And what we proposed in this part of the work is that the contact size is determined by the balance of interfacial tensions at the contact. And we're looking at interfacial tension at the cell medium interface, which is essentially a cortex tension here. Then we're looking at interfacial tension at the cell-cell interface. And then we're looking at something which we called adhesion tension, a negative tension, which we denoted here as omega, which is trying to expand the contact. And the conclusion from this part of the work was that essentially the size of the contact is determined mainly by the cortex tension at the cell medium interface relative to the interfacial tension at the cell-cell interface, and that adhesion tension as such has very little contribution to the size of the contact. So really what matters is how the cortex is assembled or how the cortex looks like at the cell medium interface and how it's being disassembled and what is left of the cortex at the cell-cell interface, and that determines how big the contact becomes. We also looked at the tissue scale, at interfacial tensions, particularly here at surface tension of tissues, and we developed some model how we can explain how mesoderm, which would be these cells down here, this is the embryo, and usually during gastrulation, mesoderm goes to the inside and ectoderm stays on the outside. And what we proposed in this part of the work is that differences in the surface tension of ectoderm and mesoderm determining the layering of ectoderm and mesoderm within the embryo. Okay, and you know, very shortly, we also started to look at force reception and mechanosensation, which is sort of a hot topic now, where we are trying to understand how forces determine behavior of cells here. In this case, we're looking at cell division. Again, we're looking at the EVL, this outside squamous epithelial cell layer. And I just show you one experiment where we show that planar tension within the EVL can determine the position of the mitotic spindle. This is an EVL cell which is about to divide, and the mitotic spindle is indicated here with a white bar. And what we are doing is we are experimentally creating an ectopic tension axis which is oriented perpendicular to the original position of the mitotic spindle, and then we are seeing if the mitotic spindle is orienting now to this new tension axis. I'll show you how we do that. We are ablating a few EVL cells up here and a few down there, a lot of tension between these two ablation points, and the mitotic spindle essentially finds this new planar tension axis within the EVL, indicating that division orientation is tension sensitive. I mean, I'm not going to speak about the mechanism which lead to this reorientation of the mitotic spindle, but there are cell shape changes and so on involved. We also, and this is just a short sort of introduction into other processes where we're looking more specifically at mechanosensation. Here we're looking at YAP-TAS and the hipposignaling pathway. And again, we're looking at the EVL, this enveloping cell layer. And what we found is that TAS goes into the nucleus of these EVL cells. And this nuclear translocation of TAS and presumably TAS-dependent transcription is tension sensitive. And you need TAS within these nuclei for the EVL, for this enveloping layer cells to specify correctly. OK, back to the topic I really would like to speak about is this before really gastrulation starts. And we're looking here at the fertilized oocyte. And what is happening is, you know, I showed you already at the beginning, you get pronounced flows of ooplasm up to the animal pool, and the yolk granules are left on the vegetable pool. This process is really what we are trying to understand. So essentially what we are starting here is we have a yolk-free cytoplasm, a little accumulation of yolk-free cytoplasm up there, which is the ooplasm. And then we have yolk cytoplasm mixture, which is demixing then during the process of ooplasmic flow. Okay, so what I will do is I ask three questions in this project. The first one is, what are the force generating mechanisms driving ooplasmic segregation? What forces are triggering this ooplasmic flows? How is ooplasmic segregation spatially temporally controlled? What controls the direction of these flows and its temporal flow pattern? And then finally we ask, what determines the polarity of ooplasmic segregation? Okay. So the first question, what are the force generating mechanisms and driving ooplasmic segregation? We first have to sort of quantify these segregation, this flow process. And what we did is we looked at the flow of the ooplasm and the movement of the yolk granules. Now what you can see is here in the ooplasm we have inserted a little fluorescent beads to track the flows more precisely. And you can see that these beads are moving upwards. And if you quantify them, these flows, you see that these flows are oscillatory. They have a certain amplitude, which is decreasing over time, and they have a certain frequency. And you see that the flows, the frequency of these flows is approximately 20 minutes between two consecutive rounds of flows. The yolk granules are not just passive, but they are moving as well. And we have just tracked here with PRV the movement of the yolk granules. You can see that the yolk granules are moving in a again in an oscillatory manner, where the amplitude is much lower than the amplitude we are seeing here for the yolk, for the ooplasm flows. And if you overlay these two flows, then you can see that they are strictly anticorrelated. meaning once the oplasm flows upwards, you can see that the yolk granules are flowing downwards. And this is essentially what this process is about, is getting the yolk granules downwards and all the oplasm up to the animal pole. So you have essentially what this description told us is that oplasm, and this is perhaps not too surprising, but just looking at this movie, that oplasm flows to the flows upwards and yolk granules at the same time flow downwards. Okay, then the question is what triggers these flows, and if you think about these flows, then you think about the cytoskeleton within the oocyte and their different elements you can assume are being involved. What we did is we interfered with microtubules using norcortazole, with actin using cytochalasin, and with myosin using a constitutive active form of myosin phosphatase. And then we're asking how would interfering with these different elements affect oplasmic flows. And what we find is that norcortazole is not doing very much to oplasmic flows. The oplasm is still flowing up. Obviously, cleavages are being affected in this case. While in case where we interfere with the actin cytoskeleton or where we interfere with myosin, much of the oplasm really remains within the yolk portion and doesn't flow effectively up. So that sort of indicates that, this is just a quantification of what I told you. Here we're looking at oplasmic flows. Blue is the control line where the untreated oocyte with interfering with microtubules doesn't do very much to it, but interfering with actin myosin reduces the amplitude of these flows. So essentially, and the same you can see here if you're just looking at yolk granule flows. Essentially, what the take-home message of that is what really matters for these flows is actin and myosin, and microtubules are actually not required. You can get rid of them. Okay, this again doesn't come completely surprising because these oplasmic flows have been analyzed for many, many years, and this is just a publication more than 30 years ago, where the lab was looking at possible mechanisms which trigger these oplasmic flows, and what they propose is an interesting mechanism, which is a very plausible mechanism. They said to trigger these flows, the only thing you need to do is you need to disassemble, or you need to reduce surface tension up at the animal pole, which leads to a deformation of the animal pole, and then like a blep in a migrating cell, and then this deformation triggers flows, and then the oplasm flows much faster than the yolk granules. So in this model, what they proposed is what is happening is that the actomyosin cortex of the oocyte is specifically disassembled at the animal pole, leading to deformation and then flows. So that was a plausible model, and we wanted to test if that is actually the case. And, it was consistent with the idea that actinomyosin actually involved in this process. So what Cheyenne, the PhD student who's doing all this work, did then is he looked at F-actin during these oplasmic flows, and this F-actin is actually in a periodic way disassembled and reassembled at the animal pole as predicted by this model. And you can just look here at cortical actin at the animal pole, and you can see when cortical actin is being disassembled at the animal pole, the oplasmic flows are starting to be triggered. So this is entirely consistent with the idea that disassembly of cortical actomyosin at the animal pole trigger these oplasmic flows. And there's a very strong correlation, a very clear correlation between the disassembly, often the disappearance of the actomyosin cortex at the animal pole, and the flow of oplasm up to the animal pole. Now, what Cheyenne then did is he looked at the tension at the animal pole, cortical tension at the animal pole, by doing cuts using a UV laser, and again, consistent with the idea of disassembly of actomyosin, the tension during the flow of the actomyosin, the leftover actomyosin cortex at the animal pole is going down. This is just looking at the recoil velocity, and this is just a quantification of it. Before the flows are setting in, this is the initial recoil velocity, then it goes down, and then it's being the cortex is being reassembled before the next round sets in. This is all consistent with this very old model 30 years ago that the specific disassembly of actomyosin, reduction of tension at the animal pole triggers this flow. And that's essentially what we thought for a while, that this is just sort of confirming what has been described before, until Cheyenne was doing one experiment by accident. Actually, what he did is he took an embryo and wanted to squeeze it into this little box here. And what he did is he, by accident, destroyed the embryo, and what he left over is with a mixture of yolk granules and oplasm. In this case, you don't have an intact actomyosin cortex anymore, and you would assume that there's not much flow left if the original model is right. But what he found, to our surprise, is that the flows are actually are still occurring in this soup of yolk granules and oplasm. So there's no cortex, there's no reduction of cortical tension up here, but still the flow is happening, indicating that there's a self-organizing property of this mixture of York granules and ooplasm, which is sort of worth looking a bit closer into. And this is just a quantification that these flows are indeed happening. This is in an intact cortex, and still you can see these flows at roughly a similar period, but a slower amplitude than what you're seeing in an intact embryo. And the beads, which he put in here, are still flowing upwards. Okay, so what is then triggering flows in this cortex-free embryos, if you want, so in these ooplasm soup? And what then Cheyenne realized very quickly that there is actually a bulk actomizing cortex, and this bulk actomizing cortex comes in waves. So you can see here, this is a wave of a bulk actomizing cortex which goes through the soup here of York granules and ooplasm, and this wave apparently triggers the segregation of York granules from the ooplasm. And now he went back to the intact embryo to see if these waves actually exist, and you can see again, we're looking at the animal pool, this would be the nucleus here, and then you see this bulk actomizing wave being initiated at the nucleus, at the position of the nucleus, and then traveling from the animal pool downwards and sort of hitting the York granules. Okay, so what is this wave doing? It hits the York granules, and apparently it pushes the York granules down. And this is what you can actually see if this is the York granule displacement, and you can see right at this point here, where the onset, where the actin wave hits the York granules start to move downwards. And that's sort of an indication that this wave actually triggers the movement of the York granules downwards. And this is the end of the wave, and then you get some relaxation here. Now, the York granules appear to be not just passive substrates in this process, but the York granules are decorated, and they're decorated with CDC42 and RAC1, which can modify and regulate the actomizing cortex. They're very heavily decorated with that, and we know in the meantime, and I don't show you the experimental evidence, that inhibiting CDC42 and RAC1 has a very strong influence on ooplasmic segregation, indicating that this network, this bulk actomizing network, once it hits the York granules, the polymerization of actomizing is being enhanced, of actin is being enhanced. Now, what we are thinking here, very in a very simplistic model, is a French press model where essentially there's a wave of bulk actomizing generated at the animal pool. It moves downwards, it hits the York granules, it's being polymerized on the York granules, and then it moves the York granules down. And by volume exclusion, you get a flow of ooplasm upwards. Okay, there was one experiment we wanted to see if that is actually, you know, a valid and plausible model. And you know, the experiment he did here is he took a little bit of ooplasm up from the animal pool before actually the segregation is setting in, and generates a little a second spot of initial accumulation of ooplasm at an ectopic location, and then he wanted to see if that leads to ectopic streams within the oocyte. And that's the experiment. What he assumed is that there's a second wave being generated down here, which then triggers what you can see here, and that's the actual experiment. You can see up there that's what is happening, what you expect to happen, and then down here was this injection. You can see that there forms a little a second site of ooplasmic segregation. So you can induce ectopic flows by just taking a little bit of the ooplasm from here and put it at a ectopic location, and then you can trigger the same waves of bulk actomizing, the same flows of ooplasm as you see usually at the animal pool. Okay, so this sort of puts evidence that there's a wave of actomizing being generated at the animal pool, traveling downwards, and then triggering the ooplasmic flows. How is that spatial-temporally controlled? You have seen it comes at a certain period, and there's a frequency to it. And what we very quickly then found out, and this again doesn't come too surprising, is that these actin oscillations do temporally coincide with the cell cleavage cycle. So this is what we see. This is the flow. And if you then look how the flow is related to the cleavage cycle, you can see that the flow sets in when the cell goes into M phase, and then it ceases when the cleavage is over again. And this is just showing you three cycles, and essentially what we found is that this depends, that these periodic flows depend on the cell cycle and the regulation of the cleavage cycle, and to see, and apparently this cycline CDK1 generation, this periodic CDK1 generation leads to actin polymerization and then the generation of these periodic waves. Now, this is something you can experimentally test, and we did two experiments to see if this cleavage cycle is indeed involved in generation of these waves and then the periodic nature of this ooplasmic segregation process. And in the first experiment, we inhibit this positive feedback loop, CDC25 by CHK1. And in this case, I find that should manage. And what we find is that the periodicity of the flow is going down, so we have, instead of three consecutive flows, we just get one flow event. We can do the opposite experiment and inhibit V1 here in this double negative feedback loop. You would assume that the frequency goes up, and this is exactly what we're seeing. The frequency goes up. This is the quantification. In the wild type, you have a certain frequency, and then if you inhibit the V1, this period goes down, and here the period goes up. Okay, so what we propose here is that the cell cycle machinery, and particularly CDK1 generated up here, triggers these actomizing waves, and particularly determines the periodic nature of these actomizing waves. Now, very shortly, in perhaps the last 2 minutes I have, is I wanted to allude to how the polarity of the ooplasmic segregation is being initially determined. What you have seen in all the movies I showed you, there is some initial accumulation of ooplasm already at the animal pool, and this essentially determines the direction of the ooplasmic flows. But how do you get this initial accumulation of ooplasm up here? This I took from a different publication here. And what we realized is that this initial accumulation of ooplasm is actually determined during oogenesis, before fertilization sets in. And particularly, we're looking at a process at meiosis I where the germinal vesicle is breaking down, which is up here. And this breakdown of the germinal vesicle triggers an interesting process within the oocyte, which is a microtubule aster formation up at the animal pool. You can see that these asters are forming up here. This is York granules. And then it appears as if these microtubule asters are pushing the York granules downwards. And there's some fusion of York granules up here as well, which might be interested in the context of phase separation if you're interested in this process. And you can see that there are very large microtubule asters formed eventually, which displace these York granules and then lead to the initial sort of accumulation of ooplasm up here. This is just showing you again in a few stills how that is forming. You see all these microtubule asters formed here, and the clearance up here, and the movement of the York granules downwards. Okay, so these microtubule aster formation have previously been associated with motor activity of microtubule motors, and what we did is we assumed that perhaps kinesin or dynein activity is involved in the formation, and that the germinal vesicle breakdown actually triggers this aster formation by triggering the motor activity of kinesin or dynein. So we did some preliminary experiments where we interfered with aster formation and aster localization. Here, aster formation, obviously, if you inhibit microtubules, then you don't get this initial clearance up here because you don't get microtubule asters. If you inhibit dynein, you interestingly see a very similar effect that you don't get a clear you don't get clear microtubule aster formation. You don't get this initial accumulation of ooplasm. And if you interfere with the actin cytoskeleton, these asters are mislocalized and you don't get clear fusion. So I'm at the end. And what we propose is that initially you have a process of germinal vesicle breakdown, which activates microtubule motors, and these microtubule motors trigger microtubule aster formation. And the microtubule asters, which are happening up there where the vesicle breaks down, pushes these York granules away and initially determines a little accumulation, or a York granule free space. And then this French press mechanism kicks in, where you essentially generate an actomizing wave, which pushes the York granules downwards and the ooplasm upwards. That's what I would like. And I just would like to thank Cheyenne again, who's done pretty much all of the work. We are currently collaborating with Guillaume and Sylvia about some simulations of this process. Thanks very much.